Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
The news from Venezuela is grim.
Venezuela's once thriving middle class is now trapped in desperation, struggling to put food on the table, some even dying from simple infections due to a lack of basic medicines.
Tens of thousands of people were out protesting today in Venezuela, demanding that socialist President Nicolas Maduro leave office.
Venezuela is at a breaking point. Thousands taking to the streets yet again today after weeks of violent protests in the capital city of Caracas. More than 400 arrested, at least seven people killed.
President Nicolas Maduro is the handpicked successor to populist Hugo Chavez, who died of cancer 4 years ago. Since then, observers say Maduro has pushed populism closer to authoritarianism, cracking down on angry demonstrators and presiding over an economy in which food, medicine, and money are in critically short supply. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Kajal Vyas is foreign correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, and he's been covering worsening conditions in Venezuela. We've invited him to talk about what's happened and why, and what might change the outlook for Venezuela's 31 million residents. He joins us from the studios of Caracol Radio in Bogota, Colombia. Kajal, welcome to Think.
Chris, thanks so much for having me.
Let's start with who's in charge. Hugo Chavez took office in 1999, died in 2013. His legacy certainly still looms large. Tell us, first of all, about the party, the United Socialist Party of Venezuela.
Sure. Well, it's presided by President Maduro, who Hugo Chavez, in his last public appearance back in end of 2012, told his countrymen that he wanted vote for Maduro and that he would prolong his legacy and continue the socialist revolution that Chavez championed over the 14-year reign. It's a coalition of many left-leaning parties in Venezuela, and they've all been kind of united under this banner of socialism that Chavez advocated, and it worked for many years because he was able to keep a very wide spectrum of Venezuela's political sphere under his command, mostly because oil prices, Venezuela kind of went during the Chavez era, Venezuela went through its biggest oil boom in its history, and it really helped him spend on so many projects and really helped kind of, and also his folksy charm and charisma and his omnipresence on television and the radio. And it just really helped him kind of create this cult-like following.
Why borrow money for all those years, even in the peak of oil revenues?
You're hitting at a very, very important question, one that I think many of us would probably like answers to. But during the Chavez era, you know, they took in roughly a little more than $1 trillion in oil revenue. One thing I always like to kind of point out is a few years ago, one of Chavez's economic architects, an octogenarian Marxist named Jorge Giordani, he was fired by Maduro after Maduro took office. But he came out and spoke to some state media and said, you know, during our Chavismo period, we took in $1 trillion and 2/3 of that we distributed to the people. And thankfully, this reporter who was doing the interview for a left-leaning publication in Venezuela was awake and asked him, well, what happened to the rest of it? And he said, well, that basically just kind of fell through the cracks. And we're talking about a third of more than $1 trillion. And so that's more or less the GDP of the country currently. And we're just talking about almost a level of mismanagement and corruption that's almost difficult to wrap your head around, how this country that should on paper be the richest, you know, in the world with relatively small population, but just cannot manage this wealth that they're sitting on top of.
Who is getting rich in Venezuela?
Well, so in recent years, since Maduro took over, he was faced with a very critical situation. One, you know, he lacked any of the charismatic charm that Chavez used to gain so much power and especially win over many of the country's poor. But Maduro also was running out of money. And what he's done in the last four years almost, is he's really handed over a lot of power to the military. I remember about a year ago or so, you could have gone through the his presidential cabinet, and it was full of military personnel. And we're talking about military men in charge of finances, of food distribution, of electricity, just any kind of important sector in the economy was put in the hands of military men. And that really helped him kind of keep control, because at the end of the day, they are the people who have the guns. And so that's kind of, we're seeing that play out now, where while about, you know, according to the polls, about 80% of the country, if not more, is opposed to Nicolas Maduro, he's been able to keep power because he has legions of National Guard and the military and the police, who they continue paying. And sometimes they pay bonuses in dollars, which are very hard, very hard to come by in that country. And they get perks, food, all that kind of stuff. And so it's helped him stay in power so far.
Of course, all these folks in the military have connections to Venezuela's, you know, provinces and regular city streets. They have relatives who have suffered under Maduro's policies. Can he be sure that every branch of the military will remain loyal to him?
Well, we're kind of seeing some of those dynamics play out at the moment. I mean, it's a really precarious situation, but one that seems extremely unsustainable. And we are, you know, every so often you see cracks. So earlier this year, there was about a dozen or so military personnel that were arrested for some kind of plotting, on plotting charges. There's been a few other lieutenants that earlier this year had fled to Colombia and made a video proclaiming their dissidence. And and there's even been past people who've been very loyal to who were very loyal to Chavez in the past. There's a general by the name of Cliver Alcala, who today is extremely vocal. And while he says that, you know, the vast majority of the armed forces is still loyal to the government, that, you know, those cracks are in danger of growing as the situation becomes more and more stressful.
So, Cajal, you've written about this agonizing moral dilemma for Venezuelan citizens and also for expatriates. Government bonds out of Venezuela have been paying terrific returns on the order of like 55% a year, but government services are not being provided. So the question is, should we, you know, protect our own finances by investing in the government, or should we pull out because the government isn't doing what it should?
Well, yeah, that's it's a big moral crisis that's being debated hotly in financial markets these days. I mean, the thing is that Venezuela, as we mentioned earlier, under the Chavez government, you know, the government issued lots of tens of billions of dollars in bonds that are traded around the world by banks and mutual funds, and probably, you know, many of the pension funds of our listeners have some holdings in Venezuelan bonds, because for many years the government always paid, and they, as you mentioned, they provide pretty juicy returns. The issue here now today is that the government has very few dollars to go around. When they were in the middle of the oil bonanza, it was fine. The government could pay its debts, also pay for food imports, do whatever they needed to do. But today they have to make a very clear choice. And it seems for the moment they've decided to squeeze food imports more than anything else. Those have fallen by almost three-fourths in the last 3 years. And so, many of these bonds bondholders are, you know, Venezuelan expatriates that, you know, live in the States and often, you know, may talk about how opposed they are to the government, but at the end of the day, they are getting those dollars in coupon payments and interest payments that perhaps could have gone to food imports. And so it's a real moral dilemma. But I've heard many economists kind of say, you know, bonds that were issued in the past are fine. It's you shouldn't give the government any new money, because that would mean, because if you buy an old bond that's being traded around, that doesn't necessarily mean the more government going in the hands of more money going to the hands of the government. But there's a very conscious effort by Maduro's detractors and diplomatic bodies around the world trying to convince people not to invest or give more financial lifelines to the government.
Could Venezuela default on all that outstanding debt?
Yeah. I mean, if you believe there's ways to measure based on the prices of bonds and the insurance on those bonds, you can often deduce a probability, a default probability. And, you know, if you look at the prices currently, markets are kind of pricing in a 90%+ chance of default in the next 5 years. And it's kind of gotten to a point where every time the government has to pay, which is a handful of times a year, you know, sometimes they have to use like these grace periods to pay. And it just, it's very evident that they're having serious trouble coming up with the cash, even though the government says that, you know, they do promise that they will never default, because a default would be extremely cataclysmic for a country like Venezuela, because just about all their entire economy revolves around oil and oil exports. And if you default, that will open you up to hedge funds. And there's a thing, you know, funds called vulture funds that specialize in these kinds of things. They will, you know, buy up debt that's about to be defaulted on, and then just have their army of lawyers making life very difficult for said country or company. And so, you know, that can mean oil tankers being seized, and, you know, a host of other actions that would totally paralyze Venezuela.
Is the problem with Venezuelan oil revenues that supplies are dwindling, or just that global per barrel prices have fallen?
It's a combination. One of the many things that the government did not do with all the money that it took in over the last 15 years was invest in its own oil industry. And so production has fallen quite substantially at many of its major installations. If I remember off the top of my head correctly, I think their production is down by nearly a fifth or a quarter in the last couple of years. And so that's a big blow to a country that badly needs it. On top of that, you know, oil prices are much lower today, less than half than where they were in 2012. And so that's a whole another issue for the government. You often hear the president blame a lot of the country's problems on lower oil prices, and, you know, saying that, you know, the government's a victim here. But, you know, that argument falls quite on its face when you just look at other oil producing countries. Almost nowhere are people facing the same level of shortages of food and medicine. It's not a very convincing argument.
What's the education system like in Venezuela? I know there's been a brain drain, but do most kids get a decent education so that if the economy ultimately wants to diversify, that'll be possible?
Well, the education system is being faced with a lot of the same problems that that any industry in the country is facing. I mean, there's no resources for education. You know, schools often don't have supplies. And also, over many years, that deification of Chavez that we mentioned, you know, people, a lot of kids were, at the end of the day, were learning just about how great Chavez was. And there's like textbooks of, you know, him walking around with the country's founding fathers and,
All right, let me jump in for a break here. My guest is Kejal Vyas of the Wall Street Journal. We're talking about Venezuela in crisis. We'll resume the conversation in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program for aspiring creative writers. You can nurture your creative talents and take courses this fall like 21st Century Storytelling. Applications are available at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Wall Street Journal foreign correspondent Kajal Vyas. We're talking about the crisis in Venezuela. If you would like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think at kera.org or find us on Twitter. We are at KERAThink. Kajal, you were saying before the break that schools have had a pro-Chavez curriculum and I suppose now a pro-Maduro curriculum, which is fine as far as it goes, but there are a lot of other skills that you need for an intelligent, educated workforce.
Absolutely. One thing that really jumps out at you, especially when you see all these images of the riots and almost daily clashes between protesters and government forces, is on the protester side are mostly the kids throwing the rocks are, you know, we're talking about youth like 17, 18 years old, many who have grown up their entire lives under this government. And just speaking to them, you really get a sense of how they see their future. I mean, so many people will say, my generation is just ruined. There's just no future here. There's no investments. There's no educational opportunities. I even if I wanted to save up to move out, I can't because you can't acquire dollars unless you're doing something illegal. I would say one of the real tragedies of the failure of the socialist revolution is just how much it's been exposed, how little they invested in education and other and even infrastructure and other kind of areas which would have maybe helped build a society and maybe helped shield itself from a fall in oil prices, which now they're pretty much left with nothing, with little to show for the whole oil bonanza.
Help me understand this. I know that petroleum is the key industry in Venezuela, but it was for a long time a country that exported surplus food. How is it that now that privately owned farms have been nationalized, the country isn't even growing enough to feed itself?
Yeah. Right around the time when Chavez takes office he won election in 98. Right around that time, so Venezuela's economy, its exports were somewhere around 69% oil, and a sizable chunk of the remainder were food exports. And so, they had, while it was a very oil dependent economy, there was some kind of slight diversification. But what happened during the Chavez era is that they became totally oil dependent. And today, oil represents about 96, if not more, percent of all the government's dollar revenue. And so while Chavez was implementing his socialist revolution and nationalizing farmland, nationalizing companies, production was just plummeting. And they were okay with that because they were able to replace that by just importing more. And now, they're not producing anything and they have no money to pay for imports. And so it's just a toxic cocktail, and it explains why the country is in the situation that it is.
So people make these dark jokes about the Maduro diet, but this is not just a little bit of belt tightening. 3 out of 4 people in the country have lost an average of 19 pounds over the last year because they don't have enough to eat.
Yeah, no, it's shocking. I mean, it's kind of a part of daily conversation on the streets. I mean, people talk about how skinny they've gotten and having to substitute proteins for more carbohydrates, and vegetables are extremely expensive, and so people eat what they can, and it's usually the least the food that's probably least good for you. And so it's a country that moves a lot on corn flour. I mean, the national food is the arepa, which is like a corn flour patty, which you can kind of stuff like a sandwich. But more and more you see people just eating just the arepa with nothing to stuff it with. I remember just about a year and a half ago, I went to a school on the outskirts of Caracas where it was just when the food shortages were really starting to kick off, and it was just horrible. I mean, a Christian charity that had a school there for a couple of years just started noticing their students showing up and fainting in class because none of them were having breakfast. And so The food crisis is just it's really, really difficult to wrap your head around over there. Yeah.
There are NGOs moving in that had their primary experience in sub-Saharan African famines.
Yeah, and it seems kind of fitting because if you look at even just the numbers of the economic numbers, so the size of the Venezuelan economy since 2013 has shrunk by somewhere around like 27 or 28%. That's a kind of like contraction that you would see in like a war-stricken sub-Saharan African country or Syria or something. The thing is, like, Venezuela hasn't gone through any of that. It's strictly, because of the government's economic system, and it's been, the consequence of this. For many of those aid organizations that you mentioned, I mean, it's been really hard to work because the government's been in denial of the crisis. They kind of lash out at any other countries that call it a humanitarian crisis. And they've also kind of refused to allow humanitarian aid from entering the country. In fact, in the last over the last month or two, we've seen a lot of videos kind of go viral on social media of National Guard seizing aid. We're talking like first aid kits and, just basic supplies coming into the country, and they're being seized at the ports, and the government says these are supplies going to use to feed these rebels and these agitators.
Wow.
And
meanwhile there's this exodus of doctors that started really when Chavez took office in 1999, but has picked up significantly over the past year or two.
There's no kind of a real government data on that brain drain, but there's been some sociologists who've done studies, and I believe like during the Chavez era, they said somewhere around 1 million Venezuelans left for left for other countries for various reasons. I mean, economic reasons, political reasons, if you maybe like 5-6 years ago we were seeing doctors leave. I mean, today it's kind of a new class of Venezuelan. Like 10 years ago there was oil professionals leaving for other countries, and then today you might see your welder from the refinery who may just have a technical expertise but is not like a somebody with a degree, and even those strata of society are trying to get out.
All right, let's go to the phones now. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's speak with Bill in Dallas. Hi, Bill.
Hi, another great show. Venezuela is now, I believe, the number one country for asylum seekers coming to the United States. And I'm wondering how often you encountered people who were talking about migrating to the United States. And I'll listen off the air. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Thanks, Bill. Just about anywhere, people are trying to get out. I would say not just the U.S., but many have come to Colombia, to Caribbean islands, even Argentina, which maybe 15 years ago seemed like another basket case. People have been very eager to go there. Spain, you name it. In fact, it's quite common in Venezuela for people to have two passports, especially people of European descent. And I would say nowadays, boy, is that coming in handy because at least they have a plan B. And so, that's extremely common to hear of people making plans, trying to leave.
What's the rate of inflation in Venezuela right now?
That's another big question mark. The government has stopped publishing basic economic data since the end of latter half of 2015, and so best we have really are kind of some IMF estimates and other economists' estimates, and you see a range of somewhere between 700% and 1,000%.
That's extraordinary. So something that cost a dollar in U.S. dollars last year might be $7 or $10 this year.
Yeah. Exactly. It's the economy is so distorted. So if you have access to dollars, you can live like a king in Venezuela on, you know, $200 a month, frankly. Because dollars are in such short supply that at the black market on the street, you can exchange each dollar for a ludicrous sum of bolivares, the local currency, and you know, average salary people are making somewhere around $15 a month, and so I mean, it's if you have access to dollars, you live quite well. Obviously, you're still victim. You still can fall victim to all the other problems in the country, like the insecurity and you know, not having water, running water, and those kinds of things. But at the end of the day, you know, if you are somebody earning in bolivares locally, it is an extremely difficult day-to-day struggle to get by.
All right, let's go back to the phones. This time, we have Raja on the line in Dallas. Hi, Raja.
Hi, Tess. Thanks for putting on the spotlight on this Venezuelan crisis and great show of your, a great fan of your show. My question to the speaker is, what is the probability that he sees that this is going the Cuba way, or does he see a higher probability that the Venezuelans will be able to get back their country? And the second part to that question is, do you foresee international involvement in resolving this crisis, and what form it can come?
Well, to take your first question, the Cuba comparison. I mean, that I would say for many years that was the goal of the government to make Venezuela into something that resembled a Cuba-like system, and. We're at a really crucial point at the moment because the next six weeks are bound to be quite volatile because the protests are likely to continue. And at the end of July, the government is planning to move ahead with this plan to basically scrap its current current constitution and rewrite a new one, which has no kind of defined period, which can technically go on for ages. And there's lots of speculation that the government is using this as a way to just basically indefinitely postpone elections, or at least postpone them until things improve for them. And so, you know, that Cuba comparison might become more and more apt. On top of that, there's also, you know, Cuba has been a very key ally of Venezuela. Venezuela for many years sent oil to Cuba for in exchange for things like doctors and government advisors, and you know, there are government Cuban intelligence figures who you know, many ways run many aspects of Venezuela's security forces, and so as I mentioned, I think that Cuba comparison is very, very is a key one. Regarding the foreign intervention, you know, if you listen to Venezuela's government, they have been claiming for about almost two decades now that they're going to be invaded by the U.S. any moment. I don't see really a intervention per se. The Trump administration has been quite mixed. They have sanctioned a number of high profile Venezuelan officials beginning in January with the vice president, who they put on their notorious kingpins list. He's facing allegations of drug trafficking, and they also sanctioned basically the entire Supreme Court in Venezuela, which has been doing a rather aggressive job of getting rid of democratic institutions. And so I would be very surprised to see any kind of foreign intervention, but maybe more sanctions.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Kjell Vjas. He is foreign correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. We're talking about the crisis in Venezuela. You can join our conversation at 800-933-5372. Next on the line, we have Marcial from Plano. Hi, Marcial.
Hi. How are you?
Very well. Thank you.
Thank you for the show. A big fan. I just wanted to go. I'm also from Venezuela. I immigrated here about 8 years ago, and I know you were talking about kind of brain drain, and I'm a physician, I'm a doctor, and I work as a pediatrician. So I just wanted to, I guess, comment. One, you know, situation is of course, preposterous how your guest is saying. But two is, more recently, I've seen more and more Venezuelan families who are seeking asylum, who have no insurance, which is a different population that I guess you would have seen here 8 years ago. Now people are coming, leaving everything to work here as washing cars and cleaning linens at a hotel and things like that, which you never saw from the Venezuelan population 10 years ago or 15 years ago. So it's one of those things that you notice the thing is getting worse and worse as you see people leaving everything behind just to come here to do whatever they can find, and sometimes even illegally, which also was not a common thing for Venezuelan population to do. So just wanted to kind of comment on that and see what maybe comment has your guest has about it.
Thank you for your call.
Yeah, no, Marcial, it's a great point. You know, that's not only just in the U.S. and Canada, as I mentioned, you know, so many, you know, Venezuela, from over many years, you know, it had a very well-established oil industry, and they produced, you know, some of the world's, you know, a fine batch of engineers and scientists and, you know, people who could, who are very capable. And those people, yeah, they've gone to so many countries. There's a big diaspora in the Middle East, in the tar sands, in Canada, and the Venezuelan kind of oil expertise has really been a boon to so many other countries. But yeah, now you're seeing so many others who are just, you know, working class Venezuelan, just selling everything they have to go to anywhere, you know, neighboring Colombia, the Caribbean islands, you name it.
We're talking about the crisis in Venezuela with Wall Street Journal foreign correspondent Kejal Vyas. If you would like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find us on Twitter. We are @KERAThink.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can cultivate your appreciation of great works of art by customizing your study with courses this fall like Inspiring Creativity Through Original Art. Applications are available at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Wall Street Journal foreign correspondent Kejal Vyas about the crisis in Venezuela. If you'd like to join us, you can find us on Twitter @KERAThink, which is where we hear from Richard, who wants to know, could an embargo of U.S. light crude oil exports and gasoline to Venezuela accelerate the downfall of the regime?
Well, that would be kind of a double-edged. Yeah, I mean, the short answer, yeah, that would be basically the end for the Venezuelan government, namely because the U.S., so in the U.S., Venezuela is, I think, the third largest is the third largest source of oil imports, and for Venezuela, you know, despite all its anti-imperialist rhetoric, still sends. Somewhere near half, I think, of their oil to Venezuela, to the U.S. And that relationship is extremely important for Venezuela because they send lots also to China, to Russia, to India. Many of the new markets that Venezuela has tried to cultivate over the last several years, a lot of those oil shipments are being used to pay loans that the government received from countries like China and Russia. And so they're not getting any new cash from that. And so the U.S. Is probably their only major cash paying customer. And so, any kind of, cutting that line would obviously be detrimental to Venezuela. But it may also be, there may also be obviously consequences for the U.S. since a sizable chunk of U.S. use comes from Venezuela.
So many people who are paying even marginal attention to the news are aware of these ever harsher crackdowns by the Maduro government on people who are protesting. I'm curious about the state of free speech elsewhere. You're a journalist working for a foreign publication. What about domestic journalists in Venezuela? How free are they to comment and report on what's happening there?
It's an extremely difficult environment for anybody trying to report on what's happening in Venezuela, especially. So over many years now, there's been a very conscious effort by the government to silence dissent. They've done that by shutting down many radio stations, new television stations, newspapers, through sanctions and just making life very difficult for them. And then on top of that, a few years ago, a number of major newspapers in the country, as well as a couple of private television channels, got bought out by these kind of shadowy investment groups with links to the government, and they just totally gutted all of the personnel and totally changed their editorial line. And you know, from one day to the next, you saw a huge change in how news was presented. Very little that would be damaging to the government would be on the front pages. So it's kind of forced a lot of journalists who I should add, you know, on top of that, anybody kind of making money in Bolivares locally is struggling just to get by. But on top of that, you know, journalists have to deal with beatings from state security forces. In recent weeks, there's been a whole string of robberies. Police will just like steal cameras and phones from reporters. And so, yeah, getting the news out is extremely difficult. And we did a story last week on some Venezuelans that have started a rather interesting initiative of actually delivering the news in person now to people. And so they're getting on public buses around Caracas, and it's spread to a few other cities as well recently. It's a rather new initiative, and people are doing it totally, you know, voluntary. It's, you know, artists, journalists out of work, or writers just kind of get onto the buses. And the bus is also quite symbolic because Nicolas Maduro, the current president, was himself a former bus driver and union activist. And so it's quite an extraordinary strategy to get the news out.
Maybe not scalable, but it's a great idea.
Well, they're hoping that through Twitter and through social media that the word spreads. And you know, just in the month that they've been doing it, they've had quite a bit of success, and it's spread at least to a few other cities. And so it may catch on.
So I'm going to ask you to make a broad generalization here, but can you talk a little bit about Venezuelan culture and maybe the sense of humor there and how people tend to deal with setbacks and how that's helping people persist, regular people persist through really, really hard times right now?
Yeah, I mean, I remember some years ago, I watched a program about people talking about what life was like under Nicolae Ceaușescu, the dictator in former dictator in Romania. And I remember somebody saying that, you know, the best jokes were from the communist era. And so, you know, the sense of humor and just kind of highlighting the absurdities of day-to-day life. There is obviously a very tragic element to it, but I think you know, Venezuelans are very known for their very laid-back Caribbean their way of being. It's quite different from the rest of South America, and it's hard, but I think that sense of humor totally helps them get through the day many times. It's grim, but yeah.
All right, let's go back to the phones now. I want to speak next with Enrique in Dallas. Hi, Enrique.
Hi there. It's great to hear your show, and I'm familiar with Venezuela. I studied with a Venezuelan. I'm a musician in New York. I studied with Rodrigo Riera. And at any rate, I went down and played some concerts there. And when I went, it was amazing because I stayed in the Hilton and I walked down looking for something to eat. And you'd find, kind of like barrio food, arepas right around the corner. And I haven't been back since then, but I enjoyed it, and it was a tremendous contrast for me. But several years ago, I went to Colombia, And I was invited to do some work there, and I went down, and I went to a little party. And the people there were talking about, they were engineers, and they were talking about the Chinese investment in the coastal region of Colombia. I thought, well, that's interesting. They're investing now. They're in Panama. They're in Colombia. What about Venezuela? I noticed you talked about the oil, Chinese yuan for oil. Is that how that works? Or?
Great questions. Thanks for your call, Enrique.
Yeah, so China is became one of the most important partners of Venezuela, and vice versa. Actually, you know, Venezuela was China's biggest partner in America. I mean, a lot of that is around oil. There's Chinese companies in the oil extraction business, but what happened under Chavez was, you know, he basically, as part of his anti-imperialist agenda, was basically making things difficult for a lot of Western multinationals, but at the same time opening the door for Chinese business. And so you saw a huge influx. Actually, starting in about 2007, China starts making massive loans to Venezuela, which over the last decade has come up to around a little more than $50 billion. And a lot of that is in exchange for oil that goes to China. But the catch in the deal is that, you know, Venezuela has to hire a lot of Chinese companies to do infrastructure works, provide medicine, manufacture phones and cars, you name it. And so there was a huge influx of Chinese for many years. But as things have soured economically over the last few years, China's had trouble getting a lot of its money back. And life's become extremely hard for Chinese expats, and so there's been a pretty mass exodus of Chinese out of Venezuela too. We did a story last year on China has one of the biggest Chinese communities in the region, and a huge chunk of the Cantonese community all comes from like one district in the city of. The district's called Enping in southern China, and apparently so many people had moved back to Enping that like the mayor's office in Enping sent a delegation back in July of last year trying to figure out, you know, what the heck was going on. And it's affected not just the bilateral relations, but even like the commercial relations on the ground for all the Chinese workers.
My guest is Wall Street Journal foreign correspondent Kajal Vyas. We're talking about Venezuela in crisis. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Help me understand this election plan for next month to create a special assembly to redraft Venezuela's constitution. What kind of people are expected to fill those seats, and what will their agenda be in changing the constitution?
Well, it's not entirely clear who's going to form this committee that's supposed to redraft the Constitution. We've seen a number. There's supposed to be a vote at the end of July to determine who's going to be on this who's going to be on this board of representatives. So far, we've seen the Maduro tap people like the oil minister, other people in. And it seems very likely that he's going to be picking many people within his own government to be the representatives. When he announced this measure a couple months ago, he had said that he wanted it to be full of the people, air quotes around that. He wanted it to be people of middle class, working, poor sectors. And they would represent, the desires of the masses. There's still so much up in the air. The opposition has planned to boycott it because, frankly, I have not really heard a good reason as to why they need to redraft the Constitution in this at this crucial juncture. There's still quite a bit unknown about how it's going to work.
Do you have a sense of the changes that Maduro is most invested in? Does he want to, say, extend the years in which he could be president?
That could be part of it. But as I mentioned earlier, I think there's a lot of speculation that, this may be used as a way just to postpone elections until who knows when. It also seems very clear that we talked a bit at the beginning about Venezuela's difficult financial situation. So by Venezuelan law, if the government wants to take on a new loan sell bonds or something into the market, that those kinds of measures need to be approved by the Congress, which since the beginning of 2016 has been dominated by the opposition. And so it used to be a rubber stamp Congress that basically let the executive do whatever he wanted, but things have gotten dramatically more difficult for Maduro. And so there's a lot of speculation that he's looking to just basically eliminate the role of the Congress, and so that he could sign financing deals with partner countries under we'll never see the terms of those deals, and so that the financing issue has also been a very key motive.
So we've seen in many parts of the world, certainly after the Arab Spring, that you can throw out a corrupt old government and bring in a new government, and the new government isn't necessarily any better prepared to lead a country out of crisis. How organized and benign is the opposition, and is there an emerging leader who might, in the event that Maduro lost the elections next year, if he were removed from office, would the country be in better shape?
That's a tough one. The opposition is not united. They are united in their calls for getting rid of Maduro, and in many ways, overhauling the country's economic system. But there's no kind of one leader leading them. I would say, in recent years, we've seen Maduro, despite all the opposition. He's been able to kind of keep them at bay by just basically taking away their resources. Perhaps more troubling for the government now is that we're seeing more and more schisms from within the Chavismo party. And so over the last couple of months, we've seen the attorney general, who was for a decade a stalwart in the socialist government, and she's been accused of locking up political prisoners, and is no saint in the eyes of many human rights watchers, but she's kind of come out vehemently opposed to the government's attempts to getting rid of the constitution, and she's saying that this is turning into an authoritarian government. And and so I think those breaks from within the government's own ranks may be more problematic. But nonetheless, there's still not one figure that I would say anybody's united behind.
Kejal Vyas is a foreign correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Kejal, it's been such a pleasure to have you with us. Thank you very much for making time for us.
Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Shelley Canavy is our technical director. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. And Jeff Whittington is executive producer. We're on Facebook and Twitter at KERA Think. The podcast is at think.kera.org. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.